Thank you very much, Kim Gordon. Steve Bertrand here. It is the Wintrust Business Lunch on this Monday afternoon. Thanks very much for tuning in. We're going to talk pizza a little bit later, and I just fumble the terminology, but I think it's Napoli-styled pizza, where it's very tightly restricted.
Sounds delicious.
Yeah, Karis Husted is here, and Jim Dahlke from Chicago Inno. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, I don't quite get it, but they have a particular oven, and they don't serve carry out because it's got to be served instantly. So, well, we'll sort that out.
But I don't discriminate on pizza. I like thin crust. I like deep dish.
I like cold.
I'm not a pizza nerd. I like all of it.
Right. I'll take it cold. I don't mind cold pizza.
Oh, yeah. I'll eat cold pizza
for
sure.
Like a breakfast pizza. Yeah, exactly.
Breakfast pizza. A little pepperoni disc with a little congeal inside. That's okay, too. There's nothing wrong with that. Okay. So I was telling Bill and Wendy that is it this week or maybe next week, they're going to be driverless Uber cars in Pittsburgh.
That's right, and it's funny. We've been having this driverless car discussion for a while now, and the question has always been like, are driverless cars years away? Are they decades away? Well, Uber is letting us know that they're actually just days away.
That is shocking to me.
It is, and Uber within this month, according to Bloomberg's story from last week, Uber is going to have driverless cars in Pittsburgh. Back in 2014, it first set up shop at Carnegie Mellon's robotic department.
Did they pick Pittsburgh because there's nothing really damage there?
A Pittsburgh burn. So they've been working really closely with the robotics department at Carnegie Mellon, and they've hired a bunch of roboticists away from Carnegie Mellon to kind of sort of build this driverless car infrastructure and future here in Pittsburgh. And starting later this month, you can hail an Uber, and there might not be someone actually driving your car.
But there will be somebody in the car.
Someone will be in the car, yes. So it's not going to be you alone in the driverless car. There will be somebody there sort of seeing to make sure everything goes all right. But it just shows you how ready this technology is and how fast this future is actually
coming. Karis, I did not see that coming. Did you? I mean, you study it much more than I do, but I still was thinking years and years down the road.
Yeah, no, I think that the speed at which it has come is really surprising. But I think it's really smart of Uber just because not many people have actually gotten behind the wheel of an autonomous vehicle. You know, it's like more something that you see out in Silicon Valley, or, you know, people think of it as happening in some Google test lab. But bringing it to Pittsburgh means that normal people who are just hailing an Uber are going to suddenly get behind the wheel of a driverless car, which is going to be pretty important for getting people comfortable with that technology.
Oh, that's a good point, right? So that they can see it's not just on the salt flats. It's actually in a city in the Northeast.
Yeah, and this is really the space race of today, right? Like Google and Tesla and everyone else has tried to get the first driverless car out there, and Uber has really got a bit of pride here being the first company in the U.S. actually.
You know, you talk about disruptive industries, right? And Uber certainly is one of those. And leading them are the thousands and thousands of drivers for Uber who are going to find themselves sort of they're not going to be needed in just a couple of years, probably.
Uber has over a million drivers sort of in its network worldwide. And yeah, I mean, the plan is to eventually phase them out. I mean, that's going to be a lot longer process because, like you said, someone actually is going to be sitting in the car, at least for the foreseeable future.
Playing solitaire, maybe.
Right. Yeah, take a nap. But anyway, I mean, the day where we have no one sort of sitting in that driver's seat, at least sort of playing like a safety role, I still think we're probably a lot further away from that.
Okay, there are a couple things on Chicago Inno in the past few days about interaction, audience interaction when it comes to radio or really anything. And one is NPR is going to now stop with their comment boxes following USA Today and I think some others, you know, because really there's almost nothing good comes from those comment boxes. But it is a way to engage people, right? And to get people to feel as if they have a voice. That's what all this technology is about. Everyone has a voice. What's going on at NPR?
Yeah, so actually NPR, while they are phasing out comments, they are working with a Chicago startup to keep the audience engagement alive. Because as you said, journalism is not a one-way street. It's sort of talking to your audience, figuring out what they want. So what they're doing is they're working with this Chicago startup called Harkin, which basically creates audience engagement tools based off questions that readers or listeners can put into their online platform. And then the reporters work with the listeners to report the story. This came out of a project at WBEZ by journalist Jennifer Brandel called Curious City. So if you listen to WBEZ and know Curious City, that was kind of the beginning of Harkin.
Let me just say right now, Karis, no one does. So anyway.
No, none of the loyal WGM listeners.
Here's the thing about that, though. So it's interaction, but it's not commenting, really, right? It's pre-action in a way. They're following the readers or listeners' guides in some way. So they're not quite react. So is it placating them, or is it really finding a way to create new content?
No, I think that it's really focused on meaningful interaction. So it's basically like a comment. So you write an article, but at that point, the article is already written. The story has already been reported. So the audience hasn't really been brought into that interaction, or hasn't really been brought into the story until they put a comment in, which is usually why you see a lot of racist, sexist, and right, just general garbage in the internet comments. And so I think what Harkin wants to do is bring the audience into the story earlier by doing sort of a question and answer style.
Well, I'm interested in the bigger idea of these comment pages, and I just wonder if they're not going to all go away one day.
Well, I mean, NPR did a very robust study on its comment section, found that just 0.003% of its online readers were actually commenting.
Right.
So the group of people who were commenting are a very, very, very small percentage.
So you might be sucking up to a number that doesn't really matter anyway. Okay, so there's that. We've got the listeners or the readers commenting that way. Chance the Rapper is doing something interesting, which is maybe related a little bit, right? He's creating a platform to build support for independent artists to get more play elsewhere.
Exactly, and it's another sort of audience engagement tool. And he's created a website called Rapper Radio. And what Chance does is allow fans to sort of tweet at their local radio stations to get independent songs heard on the radio. So
this is like special interest groups that used to send you postcards to send to your congressman, right?
Yeah, they've drafted it for you. All you got to do is hit send. So it's kind of something similar like that. You can type in your location, your local radio station show up, you can hit the station, and then the website will sort of auto-create a tweet for you that says, you know, hey, Hot 97, please play this song by Chance the Rapper. And if enough people do it, the radio station sees it, sees the interest in it. And so Chance is sort of starting with his own music to kind of get his music on the radio.
But I like that, though. Interesting guy, but he's going to help independent people. So far, only his music.
Only stuff for him. But, I mean, you can see how this platform can be expanded, right? You can see that it could grow and get other artists on there as well. So, yeah, he's starting with himself. But what a great platform to get independent music on the radio and to get the people at the radio station to see what people are really listening to.
And Chance has also been a part of the kind of movement to get more independent artists in general. The Grammys are now allowing streaming-only releases to be nominated for a Grammy as well. So that also opens up to a lot more independent artists.
Yeah, a pretty unique guy. And they're hoping he's going to save Cellular Field too with the concert sold out concert. So,
yeah, I'm going to his show in September.
You?
Yeah,
yep, I will be there as well.
Okay, I'm available. all right, we're going to take a break. That's Kyrus Husted and Jim Dahlke from Chicago Inno. This is the Business Lunch on 720 WGN. WGN 1223. This is the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN. My name is Steve Bertrand. Kyrus Husted is in the studio along with Jim Dahlke from Chicago Inno. Will Flanagan, the general manager. Is that the right?
That's correct.
Yep.
I'm so bad with titles. basically decided not to come in today. Is that pretty much? Or he's on vacation?
Well, we'll see.
Yeah, we'll see if he comes back.
On vacation out in the Northeast.
One of the stories that Kyrus has written about is this new business packed with purpose, which I think is the sort of thing that could really take off with people because it's a gift package you give, but gives back a little bit too. Explain that for me.
Yeah, absolutely. So Pact of Purpose is a new startup that's creating gift boxes, but the only products in the gift boxes have social impact. So it's things like a honey from Be Love, which is a organization that employs people who are formerly incarcerated, or a candle from Bright Endeavors, which works with new mothers. So basically you buy the gift box and that you guarantee that all the gifts inside will do some sort of social good beyond you actually just giving the gift.
And so she's trying to raise money to kick this off, or has it already started?
Right. So she's just launched the startup, and she's currently attempting to raise $30,000 on Indiegogo to get the first box launched.
And how's it going? Do you know?
So far, I know she's got about a month left in it. I think the last time I checked in, she had a couple thousand dollars raised, but still kind of working through it.
So this is kind of an old-fashioned idea, using a new-fashioned way to fund it, right?
Yeah, and then this sort of idea, you know, the fruit of the month club. I mean, all these sort
like
a little bit mysterious box subscription companies have been around for a long time, but they're becoming really, really popular. When you look at like companies like Trunk Club and Stitch Fix, we're doing that for clothes. Packed with a purpose, though, is not every month, which is kind of nice. You realize, like, you sign up for this monthly subscription, you're getting a box in the mail every month, and you're like, wow, I kind of, in over my head, I'm getting more of these than I actually want. Mm-hmm. And the nice thing about it, too, is that you can get it for yourself or you can gift it to someone else.
I didn't even think of the fact that you could just keep it for yourself, get these different things, I guess would they yeah. would be of interest to you.
Give a gift to yourself, too.
I guess, Karis, you and I are more givers than Jim is. He was just going to...
Yeah, I want one for myself over here.
Tell me about Startup Institute in Chicago, because it's I know they're, what, Boston and... Mm-hmm.
They're Boston and New York? Yeah. Yes, they're Boston-based, and previously they also had programs in New York and Chicago. It's basically a career accelerator, so it's getting students connected with tech skills that they need in a startup environment, and then connecting them with the startup ecosystem.
And they've had success here, haven't they? I mean, well, apparently they haven't. They're closing down here.
Yes. So in the last 3 years, they graduated about 210 students, but they announced last week that they're going to be closing their Chicago program. And they said that is because the Chicago startup ecosystem is still emerging and can't quite support a program like theirs.
What does that mean? Do you know? I mean, can you put English behind that?
Yeah. So basically what it means is that in Boston, New York, there are more startups that have kind of gone beyond the early stage and are ready to start hiring people with the startup skills that might be in sales, marketing, or design. They're not necessarily the core developers, but they're the people who are going to fill up a startup as it's growing.
And yet you're right that 95% of the students here found jobs.
Yeah. And we've seen that throughout the community. I mean, I run into people in the community from Startup Institute quite often. I think for Startup Institute itself, though, they said they're laser focused on profitability right now. So I think they just took a look at their three branches and said which one is doing the best, and Chicago was the one not doing as well.
How do they make their money? Is it from the students paying them?
Yeah, so tuition. They have a tuition,
right.
Yeah, mm-hmm, which is
fairly obvious, I guess.
Yeah, a little under $10,000
okay.
for the, I believe it's eight week program.
So their ratio of success isn't as important as their gross number of students, and there just aren't that many students.
Yeah, or it's I think it's more that they're just not able to find the interest in kind of going into this.
And I think that's might be something you're seeing just as the tech economy sort of cools a little bit in general. I mean, some companies aren't at the rapid pace of hiring that they were 12 months ago and past. So, I mean, I think you're starting to see tech hiring cool just a little bit, and companies like Startup Institute are being affected by that.
Art Dahlke, you wrote a piece, you tend to write sometimes longer pieces of bigger issues, and we're not going to give it the time it deserves today. But this idea that you can measure success in an economy, a startup economy, by the serial entrepreneurs. And we're starting to see some progress in Chicago when it comes to that. Explain that for me.
Yeah, I mean, we've been on your program, luckily, and had a chance to talk about some of these in the past. But what we're really seeing is some of the biggest serial entrepreneurs in Chicago, from Brad Keywell to Eric Lakofsky, both of the Groupon guys, to Chris Gladwin, the former CleverSafe founder. All of these guys within the last few years are moving on to their next venture, and they're taking really big swings and tackling some really important issues. And it's really kind of put Chicago tech on the map, and it's really a sign that the ecosystem itself is growing up a little bit.
So it's not really so much about building a better mousetrap. It's what you do after you build that trap, right?
Exactly.
What you do next.
You have your billion-dollar exit. You get a little money, and now you go into the next thing. And so rather than kind of stay at the venture that you sort of grew from the ground up, you're moving on to the next thing. And all these, it seems like a lot of former founders are coming together at the same time to move on to their next gig.
That's Jim Dahlke. Karis Husted here as well from Chicago Inno. Where do people read more about these stories?
ChicagoInno.com. Sign up for The Beat, which is our daily newsletter.
Absolutely. Thanks, guys. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
It's the Business Lunch on 720 WGN. It is the best day of the week. It's Pizza Day, 12:36 here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Steve Bertrand. A little bit later, we're going to talk podcasting. Chaima Black is the man behind Dynasty Podcast. I think it's the longest music podcast in existence. He started right away, so we'll talk podcasting with him a little bit later. Right now, who knew that I would need such a course on pizza living in Chicago as I do? But I did not know much about Neapolitan pizza. How'd I do, right?
Did Good,
I
say
it right?
Great.
Nick Nitti is here, and he's the guy behind Forno Rosso Pizzeria. Nick, welcome to the Business Lunch.
Thank you.
All right, so why I want to talk about where you are now, but let's start a little earlier than that. You started by selling New York slices to Chicagoans.
Yeah, I started in 2003 in the financial district. I had a New York-style pizzeria.
And then how did the Napoli stuff come about?
Well, being from Italy and living there for many years, I went to do my culinary school there in Napoli. And then I came back and decided to open up a Neapolitan pizzeria here.
Why? What made you decide to make the switch?
Well, just always going to Italy and having that style pizza and knowing that there wasn't much of that here in Chicago. I wanted to bring a little bit of that back here.
And so what is that style? What are we talking about
here? Neapolitan style pizza, we're part of an association called the VPN.
Yeah.
They govern how we make our pizza, at what temperature we cook it, the ingredients we use, the method in which we stretch the dough, how we make our dough, how we cure the oven from A to Z on all levels.
I kind of laughed there because I had never heard of such a thing. So there's no Chicago deep dish council, right, measuring people or New York style pizza measuring things. But so why is it that this Neapolitan pizza has this?
Well, that's the birthplace of pizza. So the margherita pizza was named after a queen in Italy who they made this special pizza for her. Her name was Queen Margherita, so she had that pizza named after her. And then the other pizza they brought into existence was the marinara, which was the traders for spices would trade with the fishermen for dough and, you know, fish.
So it's Marco Polo's pizza.
Yeah, something like that.
But, you know, it's almost like a wine where it has to meet certain sort of regulations in order to be qualified.
Oh yeah, so they take it pretty serious. So they regulate us, and we have to show them videos on how we make our dough, right? How we do the fermentation process of it, how we handle it. So it's pretty serious.
When you talk about how you handle the dough, you don't refrigerate it.
No, never refrigerated. It's a 24-hour rise. I have a separate dough room that controls the humidity and the temperature in the restaurant, so I'm able to emulate the atmosphere and the
You're saying I couldn't go to Trader Joe's and buy a refrigerated pizza crust to make a Neapolitan pizza?
No, probably won't be the same.
There's another word here that I'm not even going to try to pronounce, but what is it you call someone who, well, I'll try, pizzaiolo? What is that?
So a pizzaiolo is a pizza chef. In Italian, it means, it's pronounced pizzaiolo. So you're specific to knowing how to make Italian style, Neapolitan style pizzas.
And you're certified?
Yes, I am.
And you went to Italy to get that certification?
Napoli.
What's the, is there such a distinction in Italy too?
Oh, yes.
Yeah, there is.
Yes.
So what was it like when you first got there? I mean, you knew how to make pizza, right?
So yeah, it was a little difficult because I was used to the New York style stretching, and you know, their techniques are totally different. You know, they want you to touch the dough as least as possible so that way it stays nice and soft and elastic. And, you know, there's no machine. It's everything's done by hand.
Do you speak Italian?
Oh, yeah.
I just wondered if they were making fun of you and you didn't know.
No, I knew everything they were saying. So
now you brought some pizza today.
Yes, I did.
Well, thank you very much for that.
No problem.
But you kind of broke a rule, didn't you?
Which one is that?
I thought there were no takeouts, no delivery.
You know what? It is hard to deliver this style pizza, but what we do is we don't cut them. So we leave them whole, and when people take them home, they'll throw them in the oven for a couple of minutes, and they're perfectly fine.
So you do sell takeout?
Yes.
Oh, okay. I thought maybe you didn't. All right. So tell me also about then the fact that, you know, maybe this is part of it. You kind of have to educate your audience in order to fit so they know what they're eating.
Oh, yeah. Every day in the restaurant.
Is it frustrating that we think we're such a pizza town and we don't know this pizza?
It's a battle that we have every single day. It's people come in and they, you know, this pizza's unique. It's very soft and it's very thin. So they're used to like this big, you know, thick, you know, pan or stuffed pizza. And you can eat a whole pizza of this kind and not feel it like a big glump in your stomach, you know?
All right. So tell me about the business. You started, your first one was on the Northwest Side.
Yeah. 3719 North Harlem. That's my old neighborhood.
Dunny. How long ago?
4 years ago.
Okay. And then you have a new one in the West Loop area.
Yeah, Randolph and Aberdeen, right across from the old Harpo Studios.
Do the restaurants have to be separately certified?
Yes.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Because, you know, each restaurant has its separate pizzaiolo. So I'm the head pizzaiolo for all the restaurants, but then I have to have someone in charge of each restaurant, and they have to make a video and send it into Italy, and they have to get approved, and it's a huge process.
Oh, we're talking to Nick Nitti, the guy behind Forno Rosso Pizzerias. You know, a lot of 16-year-olds just make pizza around.
Yeah.
That would be a lot cheaper than getting people certified and all of that.
Yeah.
Well, go ahead.
It's really unique. You know, we take it serious. We import all our products from Italy, all our flour, tomatoes, cheese. We get cheese flown in fresh twice a week from Italy, so.
And so have you found, who's your audience or who's your customer base? Is it someone looking for pizza, or do you find there's sort of Napoli aficionados that find you, seek you out?
I think it's a little bit of both. One of the nicest things that we see a lot is people come in and be like, wow, I haven't had this style pizza since I was in my honeymoon in Italy. Right. And like, it brings us back to being, you know, in Naples or on the Amalfi Coast. So that's like a huge.
You love that.
Yeah, that's awesome.
We didn't talk about the ovens yet either, right? Because no. Part of the individual certification is you got to have a very special oven for this.
Yeah. So we use strictly wood burning. No gas assisted. The floor's usually around 900 degrees. The dome's at 1,000. The pizzas cook in about 60 to 75 seconds. So, and we
really?
Never, yeah, we never cook more than 4 pizzas at a time in the oven, just for the recovery time of the stone and making sure that each pizza gets cooked properly.
Are you doing what you love?
I love it. Do every you? Day, yeah.
What's the best part?
Honestly, the best part is just knowing that we can make people feel like they're in Italy. So, like, if we can bring a little bit of Italy here, it's a great, you know, feeling.
What's been the hardest part?
The hardest part has been educating people on the style of the pizza. But once we get them in the door and they taste it, they fall in love.
So is the style all about the crust? Because I know you have brunch now in the West Loop, and you're offering breakfast pizzas.
Yeah.
I don't know if that would have to meet some sort of approval.
Well, no. As far as the brunch, I don't think they really get involved with us too much on that.
Okay.
But, you know, we use the same dough for our breakfast pizza. We just use different toppings. Like, we'll do asparagus and, like, an egg on the top and, like, fresh tomato. It's really good.
Nick Nitti is here from Forno Rosso Pizzeria. How do people find out more information?
Forno-Rosso-Pizzeria.com.
And it's all there.
Yeah.
And are there instructions in how to play beer pong?
Oh, yeah.
Tell me about the beer pong.
Yeah, so we do a beer pong for brunch. We set up a table outside on the patio. Just something fun for our guests to do, enjoy the weather.
Yeah, I had no idea about this, so I'm glad you came in and explained it for us.
Yeah, you should come by and try it one day.
I'll do it. Nick Nitti, the CEO and owner of Forno Rosso Pizzerias. Thanks very much.
Grazie.
It's the business lunch. It's the hardest time. I took a group to Italy a few years ago. Italian's hard.
Yeah.
I mean, it's much harder than French or Spanish. I had the hardest time. I'm afraid to say anything. Pizzaiolo.
Pizzaiolo.
It's the Business Lunch on 720 WGN. Thanks very much, Orion. Steve Bertrand here on the Business Lunch Monday afternoon. Haima Black and Audrey Sutherland are in the studio. We're going to talk a little podcasting here. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you.
Haima, talk to me about the Dynasty podcast, because you were one of the first to do a musical podcast, right? Back in the day, was it 1850?
It was 1850. So Dynasty podcast started in 2005 here in Chicago. It was the first music podcast launched here, and it's been going now 11 years.
So 2005, I'm thinking, I used to do audio interviews, author interviews for BarnesandNoble.com.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so like their Meet the Writer show, I was the host of that. And that was kind of at the beginning of they didn't podcast, really. You would have to go to the website and listen to it at the site.
Right.
I'm trying to remember, that ended maybe 2004.
Yeah, and it was like more of like a streaming thing.
Exactly, yeah. And so podcasting 2005 to today is pretty remarkable change.
Yeah, it's very different. You know, the analogy I always make is that, like, Serial, of course, kind of broke it through the mainstream, and now people know what podcasting is.
Right. And have you found that your interest is increased in Serial?
Yeah, and even more than the interest, just the awareness.
Right.
When I tell people, like, oh, we do podcasting, they know what that is.
Well, Serial, we should say, was a pretty remarkable podcast that followed a... I didn't listen to it.
It basically followed a serialized storytelling format around real life, you know, crime.
In a way, it was almost like the audio version of Making of a Murderer.
Yes, yeah, very much. And you know, and it was very compelling, especially because it was kind of the first one to really. I don't know if it was the first one to ever do that, but it was the first one to do it on a large scale.
Right.
You know.
Well, it got mainstream media talking about podcasts.
Absolutely.
Okay, but you do a lot more than a musical podcast. It's you talk about the podcasting industry. You have these live cultural events around the city. As I was telling you off the air, you tend to do so much that it's hard to figure out exactly what you do, Haima.
You know, I think it just kind of comes from, like, really liking the work and always wanting to be busy. So if I have downtime, I'd immediately go into, like, why am I not working on something?
Tell me about these cultural events.
Sure, so... Something that I have found over the last few years, and especially over the last year and a half, is that the live podcast format, where we go into a venue, you know, we've done this at Rocket Bar and Grill, Chicago Athletic Association Hotel, you know, we go to, like, these, you know, great institutions around the city that are gracious enough to host us, and you do a live version of the podcast there where it's a panel or maybe a workshop, you know, it's like four
professionals talk about, like, you know, how to build your brand, how to get your band booked at a venue, things like that. People come out for that. It has nothing to do with me, but it's because we've been fortunate enough to continually get great panels of people.
Well, you're being humble there, because it does have to do with you. You're creating the audience. But it's funny too, isn't it? Because we're coming back around to the very public version of listening to things. I mean,
right.
The podcasts are the ultimate in privacy. You know, no yes. one else is listening when you're listening. And now you're having success with making it a public event again.
I know, it's very cyclical. But yeah, the public version of it is where we're just seeing, like, such an enormous response and return and the conversation, and it carries over online where people are, like, you know, tweeting or Facebook messaging us and saying, like, oh man, I had a great time at this event, or I wish I could have made it. Like, the primary conversation driving what we do is around the live space.
So you're talking to hundreds of people who do show up.
Yeah, this summer we've started having, like, really actually pretty notable response, which has been very surprising and significant and great.
And a couple coming up, right? One focusing on music journalism.
Mm-hmm.
What's that about?
So on September 14th, and we haven't publicly announced it on Facebook, but yeah, we can talk
about
it.
Here we go.
On September 14th at Chicago Athletic Association, we have a panel coming up based around how to break into music journalism. So we have Lior from The Reader, the music critic from The Reader, Lior Galil. I hope I'm pronouncing his last name right. Josh Terry from The Red Eye. You know, I don't have, like, everybody in front.
We
have, like, so many coming up.
No,
we
have spring it at you.
We have so many coming up. So that's our music journalism one. And we have about four or five speakers for each that we're going to be announcing soon. But that we have Corbin Reef coming from Rolling Stone. He's a Chicago freelancer who writes for a lot of great outlets. So that's the music journalism one. We have a branding, like, creative directors and branding panel happening at the beginning of September. We're doing them every single Wednesday now.
Probably a younger audience, right?
Yeah. What we're finding is that it's a lot of college students, because I teach at Columbia College, and it's not strictly Chicago or Columbia students, but we're finding that the audience that's coming out to these is a lot of college students looking to learn, you know, looking to connect, looking to network, all those kind of things.
Yeah, it's a fascinating thing to me. I mean, I hadn't really thought of it until we started talking, but how this is becoming such a shared event. I mean, probably. Mm-hmm. Now, Audrey is here. She's your producer.
Right.
But she also has a nice little initiative beginning this week, right? Audrey, tell me about that.
I do, yeah. So this Wednesday, I'm hosting my first panel of the series. It's Female Entrepreneurs in Chicago's Creative Industries. So I'm pretty excited about that.
Where can people go and see it?
Yeah, it'll be at Chicago Athletic Association Hotel from 7 to 9.
And what have you found about women entrepreneurs in Chicago? Is there sort of a unifying thread to them? Are there commonalities that you've identified?
Yeah, I think we've been wanting to do this one for a while. It's cool being an entrepreneur myself. I really want to kind of bring all of these women to the forefront, you know, showcasing what they're doing, and really kind of bringing all of these women together and, you know, having them meet each other, learn from each other and everything like that. So I'm
and
really excited.
After making Jaime look good for so long, it's time that you could take the spotlight too, right?
Exactly.
Okay, so the big question is, well, I was going to say anyone can do a podcast, which isn't true, first of all.
Yeah.
Very few people can make money doing a podcast.
That's harder. And that part's harder.
Have you figured out how to do that?
That is an everyday thing. I mean, I can't say that we've never made any money on it, but we're not making enough money where I'm like, time to go buy a condo in the Gold Coast at all. Like, you know, I'm making, like, you know, some money to cover, like, some gas and parking and groceries, and I'm not complaining, but it is an uphill. You know,
I'm thinking of Jed Clampett shooting in the backyard and striking oil. is that what you have to do to make it in the podcast world? I mean, to get us, because there probably are a lot of stories out there, storytellers that were as good as Serial that mm-hmm. didn't catch on like Serial.
Oh, yeah. And anytime anyone's successful, and I'm not even remotely comparing us to Serial, but anytime anyone has success in any industry, it's like obviously part talent and part timing, too.
Right, you know,
right place, right time. And Serial, of course, had the goods to back it up, but they also they hit at the right time, you know? So yeah, you know, we've been able to, like, procure, like, some sponsorship, some live events and things like that just help us kind of, like, keep the engine going.
Right. And then the oil will come one day.
You know, let's hope. But right. I mean, you know, like you'll be talking into the mic whether or not that happens.
Right,
you're just
exactly.
doing it because
you're doing
love
what
it.
You want to do, which is the important part.
Yeah.
Hyman Black and Audrey Sutherland, thanks very much for coming in. Real quick, how do people find more information?
Yeah, dynastypodcast.com. And it's hard to hear this when we say it, but Dynasty Podcast with an S at the end. So dynastypodcastplural.com. And that's our username on every social platform. So you can find us anywhere, and we're always, you know, talking to people.
Excellent. Great to see you guys. Thanks
Thank
very
you
much.
So much.
It's the Business Lunch on 720 WGN.